I realized quite some time ago, probably around junior high, we don't have to talk about how long ago that was if we don't want to, that we all have different relationships with vehicles. And I even just look around this room, and with the little bit that I know about the people in this room, I think, yeah, we do have different relationships with our vehicles, don't we? And those relationships have enough facets, and they provide, if we wish them to, I think such involved metaphors and expressions for our lives that we could probably spend like the next 30 minutes talking about just that. In fact, we might actually more or less do that this morning. And that might seem like a curious choice, but I think it also might provide a window into a shared experience that I'm feeling like more and more of us are having in common. For a couple of years when I was in senior high, I was away from home at a boarding school. My choice, just to be clear. It was kind of in the middle of nowhere, at least in terms of infrastructural support, so a lot of the kids had some kind of car. And in the winter, my dad let me borrow one of the unused trucks from his construction company, so I had a way to get around. Most of the kids had what one of my siblings still calls shit student cars, which is a whole category of vehicle, you know, as most of us know. But one of my friends had a car in it that had a stereo that was worth more than my dad's truck. You know, like there were those. And there was another classmate that I had who lived nearby, and he built basically street-legal race cars in his dad's workshop, like super serious hot cars. And he'd bring them to the school campus and do these massive burnouts on the main street, just sort of a way, I think, of, you know, letting the establishment know he was there. I had another classmate who was from a logging town in BC, also a heavy-duty mechanic kind of family, and he had built himself this massive 4x4 that actually had a turbocharged diesel from a skidder, if you know what a skidder is. It's a logging machine in it. So there was all of that going on, as well as the shit student cars. And maybe those influences were part of why I definitely tied some of my identity up in my vehicle once I got past the borrowed pickup stage of my life. When I wasn't at school, I lived at home. I had a decent paying job working at my dad's construction company, so I could eventually, air quotes for reality, but I could eventually afford to buy interesting vehicles, mostly 4x4s, which I did. And because I liked music, I often, you know, put good sound systems in them. And I thought I was pretty cool, and I have some really embarrassing pictures to prove it. I'm not going to show them to you this morning, but I did look at a couple of them. I was like, do I really want to subject people to this? No, just use your imaginations, okay? I definitely thought I was all that. But over the years, as I have become post-cool, that's shifted a bit. And maybe it's kind of an accumulation of changes that in my story and our family story have had a lot to do with having kids and all the realities that go along with that. But I've come to realize that what I truly, really care about now when it comes to a vehicle is that it will start when I turn the key, it will reliably and safely do its job, and it won't leave me or my family stranded somewhere. That's kind of it. That's the list. And beyond that, if it has a good sounding stereo, that's nice. But I'm not going to like spend a bunch of after car purchase dollars on it because, among other things, you can buy really great Bluetooth earbuds for a lot less and use them in a lot more places. And they also send a signal to the kids that right now I'm not available. And so, right, bonus points and less money. But here's what I'm really thinking about when I talk about cars. I'm thinking about all the conversations I'm having with people these days who are finding, as somebody recently said to me, that this fall, the transitions are kicking their butts. Let's stay with this vehicle metaphor just a little bit longer. Let's say that the way that we feel about having agency in our lives is akin to choosing to be able to get in our car and go where we plan to. We take our intentions, we climb into the car, we turn the key, and we drive to our destination. We do what we planned, and we drive home. Awesome. But you know that moment. Maybe some of you don't, but I suspect many of us do. You know that moment where we gather our things, we get in the car, we turn the key, and we hear tick. Like we just hear that little click of the solenoid, but not the subsequent result. Or maybe if it's not quite that gone, we hear that slow, you know, that whoa, whoa, that sound? Yeah, okay. But we don't hear the sound of the engine coming to life, and we realize that whatever else might be the case in this moment, we won't be doing what we planned, like not this time, right? So we're in that space. Because this time, when we turned the key, the car didn't start. And that, on a good day, is disconcerting or annoying, And maybe on a more consequential day when we've already loaded the, you know, metaphorical kids, dog packages, maybe all of the above into the back, it can pretty much wreck us. Like, it can be pretty devastating, right? And as it pertains to happiness, let's just say that in moments or even seasons like that, happiness doesn't even feel like it's up for consideration. It's not one of the available options right then. So, as I'm reflecting on these conversations that I feel so privileged to have, I'm wondering if there's a way to kind of peek under the hood and find some potentially helpful ways to consider what's up, to see if that learning might make a helpful contribution to our lives in general, and in the context of our extended consideration of the pursuit of happiness, maybe to that in particular. I think we'll sort of be in a more general space around that stuff today. And that's necessary, that it would be in general terms, and not equally applicable to all of our circumstances and realities. But my hope, as always, is that most of us can at least find something helpful or catalytic in that. Troubleshooting first, you know, because if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Why won't a car that started yesterday start today? Now, for those of you that are car people, and there's at least a couple in the room, hold that, this will be general thought, okay? Despite the fact that cars have evolved a lot to the point where fixing them yourself is becoming an increasingly improbable endeavor because of all the computerization, but despite that, and that none of what I'm about to say would translate as directly to your Tesla, and also, can I just say, if you can afford a Tesla, this whole metaphor might sort of sound like blah, blah, blah to you. So there's that. But most of us still drive vehicles whose engines need three things to run. They need fuel, they need spark, and they need oxygen. And they need some source of stored energy, almost always a battery, to start the process of using a spark to make a fire out of fuel and oxygen, which then provides energy for us to get where we're going. So very broad strokes, like I said. Our culture has trained us to often think of ourselves in not dissimilar mechanistic terms. When we see a particularly powerful or durable person, we might unapologetically or even admirably sort of say, they're a machine. Like it was a virtue that we were noting. We're doers, and we are surrounded by the message that reinforces the idea that that is a positive and a desirable way to live. Now, I don't want to create an unsupportable binary here, because of course we do things and we need to do things. So this is not doing is evil. Just get out of that space if you can. Let me emphasize this and then we'll kind of find our way back a little bit, okay? I don't do a lot of shopping, but when I do, it's often at Home Depot because renos. Anybody notice their current advertising slogan? How doers get more done. And this morning I had the voice. I could have done that. How doers get more done. Also, stay 6 feet apart from everybody. It's not like how doers could get better work done. It's not like how doers can balance their lives or be better. It's just like, you're a doer, and this is the place where you can get more done. It's like doing is the best thing that you could lean into, and we're going to help you lean in further, right? That's sort of the whole thrust of the ad campaign. So, if the working assumption of many of the messages that surround us is the assumption that doing is good and hence doing more must be better, this would be me trying to contribute to some balance around that. And I'm going to suggest, dangerous thing to do, but I'm going to suggest an alternative slogan and a couple of ideas to follow it. And remember, this is in response to too many of us, too often, having the experience of turning the key of our lives and finding that our engine won't fire up like it did yesterday. Slogan first. This was hard. I'd like you to know I put some effort into this, okay? So many ideas, so few words. And despite the fact that I often kind of give advertising a rough ride, because I think it's a way of reducing the size of the space in which we're thinking in many instances, I often also really admire the distillation and the creativity that's required to sort of fit big ideas into short sentences, that there is an art to that. Anyway, how about this? How to do and be happier. Let me tell you what there's lots there to critique. I'm going to leave the critical thinking to you, but let me tell you what I like about it, okay? I like that you can read it a bunch of different ways. It feels like that's part of what makes an advertising slogan interesting. It all depends on the emphasis. So in this case, you could sort of separate doing and being. How to do and be happier. Or if you change the emphasis a little bit, you could turn it into how to do and be happier. Right? So that happiness is something that you be as well as something that you do. Huh? Huh? Tell you what, next career. Nah, never mind. Had my shot at that. All right. That's what I like about it. You be critical. But let's return to our troubleshooting. So the first stop is to note that no battery can run forever without being recharged. When we find that battery, it's going to be a game changer, right? And there's a lot of people and a lot of money going into trying to basically find that battery or something closer to it than what we have right now. It's a fascinating. If you ever want to be intrigued by items that have changed the world, Spark, CBC's technology show, just did a two-parter on the battery. Really interesting stuff. All to say, they don't run forever without being recharged. Batteries don't generate energy. They just store it, right? And these past couple of years have definitely interfered with many of the ways that we as humans recharge. It's interesting to sort of think about and reflect on the experience of isolation as it pertains to or touches on this metaphor. You would almost think that sort of logically, and if you were using a physical analog for this, that a culture that demanded for a period of time less visible activity would also then require less expenditure of energy. But I'm thinking that that's not the way it works. That certainly doesn't seem consistent with the experience that many of us have had. And part of that I would pin to isolation, as distinct from solitude. Solitude is chosen, just as a way of understanding that word. And it can be deeply replenishing. Isolation, I would contend, even when it's chosen, if we're going to talk about what isolation points to as a word, that's not replenishing. That's depleting. And enforced isolation has some uniquely debilitating aspects to it because we're not only cut off from others, but our agency to do something about that is impacted by the very process itself. This is, just to be clear, this is not a categorical critique of lockdowns, but I think it is a reasonable general observation about some of the impacts of them. So a lot of us, it feels like, could do with some recharging. And we might have thought, in fact, we didn't just think this, we advertised it as a culture, that once the directives changed, we're just going to barrel back out there. We're going to be back at full charge in no time. The economy is going to do what? It's going to come roaring back. We do not have the time, and I do not have the expertise to parse the problem that equates a roaring economy with healthy human beings. But let's just say that's a problem in itself as a singular kind of connection. But it turns out, and I know I'm moving in and out of this metaphor, so I hope that's working okay for you. It turns out that some batteries, at least as we humans might be like them, also, and this was especially true in the pre-lithium battery era, in literal battery land, also have a memory. Some batteries don't readily come back to a full charge once they're partly run down. In fact, some batteries have to be deliberately drained all the way down if we want them to fill all the way back up. And if we don't do that, what happens is they just take less and less charge every time. They show that they're fully charged, but they're actually they're storing less energy every time. So stop number two on our troubleshooting might be to ask ourselves if perhaps we're the sort of metaphorical battery that need to go down by choice before we go back up. I have a vague memory that I did not look up of empty that I should be filled in the King's English somewhere from back in my religious past. And I realize that's not necessarily strictly pertaining to this, but that idea that as human beings, when we deliberately empty ourselves, we are then open to a different kind of filling, that's a wider human truth. And that might sound a little bit like the opposite of what we think should happen, but just stay with me for a moment. What if our need and desire to feel replenished, to feel filled back up when we're depleted, might depend on our choosing to, first of all, empty ourselves? What if there's an interdependent relationship between those things that is essential? And if that idea has some merit, what does that even mean in practical terms? Well, the first thing that it might mean is to stop functioning as a human doing and spend some time deliberately as a human being, consciously doing that, consciously contrasting those human experiences. We need to stop draining the battery partway and just be still. Just let it, to the degree that we are able, let it drain all or more of all the way. Not so we can get back at it sooner and more productively, but just to be renewed as a human being. Like the empty part, the bottom part of that cycle of our square breathing, where we just sit empty. I was talking with somebody recently. They're a fairly high-level athlete and trainer, and they are doing, they're learning breath hold stuff right now. Like, go to the bottom of the pool, grab two 20-pound dumbbells, walk the length of the pool, let go of the dumbbells, come up for air kind of training. Like, it's pretty intense. And they were telling me about what they feel like they're learning about themselves and about what it takes in terms of being present to talk to that urge to breathe and tell it that it is, it doesn't have you, you have it. In the end, of course, we need oxygen, right? But the ability for ourselves as humans to press into that space where we can teach our body that we know the message that it's sending, we are conscious of it, we cooperate with it, but it does not govern us. This is a cooperative experience between mind and body, and I would say spirit, because my view of the human person includes that. That's an interesting space. We got a lot to learn there, I think most of us. So that's partly what I'm talking about when I'm talking about this choice to empty. This idea, I think, can sound like utter nonsense if we believe that our value as persons is pinned directly to our output, to our productivity. And that's a constantly and deeply reinforced idea in our culture. You are what you output. This is one of the reasons why when you talk to senior persons or people who are dealing with disabilities or limited abilities or a change in outputting kind of abilities, you often end up in a conversation that includes wrestling with the person wrestling with their value in the context of the society. I can't produce, so I have no value. That challenge, right? It's not very hard to see why depression and seniors often go together when you look at it through that lens, is it? You're no longer a contributing member of society. Like, why are you here? Why are you taking up space? You know, it's interesting that I get that this idea that we might be more than our output, more than our productivity, there's ways in which this is a profoundly countercultural idea. There are very few voices in our world every day that say stop. And I know by experience that the voices that do say that often reside in the last places we go for help before we collapse, before we can't go anymore, or where we end up when we do collapse. They are often the voices of caregivers, of doctors, of therapists, of the people we end up hearing from when we turned the key and the car just did not respond. And they say things to us that begin with phrases like, if you don't start to take care of yourself. Now, here's a curious and I think noteworthy thing about choosing, however we do it, and there are myriad ways we can do it, a curious and noteworthy thing about stopping doing. In our car metaphor, I've only referenced recharging the battery. It felt like an obvious target. But for us as humans, choosing to stop can not only recharge the battery, but replenish the fuel, brighten the spark, and open up the path that's used to let the life-giving oxygen flow in. And as a bonus, it can change the way we think about and interact with what we do with the energy that follows on that renewal. It's a really pretty remarkably full orbed potential. But how might we even do such a thing? Honestly, it can just feel impossible. Like, I'm looking out across this room and I'm thinking about what I know about people's stories and their work and their lives, and thinking about the folks who are joining us on a live stream the same way, and just feel like, I mean, is this just me reflecting, painting all of humanity with some relatively luxurious brush that is now my circumstances, somebody whose kids are all adults, let's say, rather than all tearing around the house full blast all day, all night. Well, maybe hopefully not all night, but it can feel like it all the time is the point, right? Is that what this is? And I think back on those years as a parent in particular, and I think about where I would have or did find occasion to stop. And what comes to mind is that the stops were relatively brief. And they required, personally at least, they required me to pay real attention to the margins in my life. Because it was often in the margins that I was able to create that kind of a moment. They often happened when what I really wanted to do was not that. Or I felt a sense of urgency to do something else with that little gap, because my list was still growing faster than the things, like, there was more things coming onto it than I could take off it. All the time. So why would I stop under such circumstances and be still, be silent, even for a few moments? It's not easy, it's not obvious, is it? It might feel impossible because we're thinking of it like we think about other kinds of doing, like a task that we need to accomplish. And in some ways, that's true. There are aspects of stopping that require deliberate effort and engagement, right? Because this usually has something to do with time as well. But there are also aspects of it that are about being receptive, that are about the lens we use to look at the experiences we're having all the time. Not just about stopping all the experiences we have all the time. So surprise, surprise, it's about balance, like so much of life. And to move deeper into that idea, I think we need to move beyond the mechanical metaphors that we've been using. I think we need to move into a space that has more room for mystery and yet also includes a space for physical engagement. And to put it much too simply, I think we need to, and we have occasion to start right here, where we are, both literally and as an idea. So I want to do both of those things. And this is an aside, but post-pandemic, are we post-pandemic? In this space, I have been reminded in a way that's felt visceral to me of the value of choosing some moments, some hours. This is a big chunk of time. Like, if you do this on a Sunday morning, that's a big block of time. And choosing to do this is a way in which we can choose collectively as well as individually to slow it down and even stop. It's one of the reasons, from my perspective, why we breathe together. It's a shared commitment to empty, to receptivity, to openness. I don't think there are very many things. There are others, of course. This is not exclusive to this kind of an experience, but it's a short list of things in the world that would say this really matters. Stopping really matters. That is, by the way, in the Christian tradition, and before that, standing on the Hebrew tradition and mythology, this is, of course, the idea of Sabbath. At its core, the word itself, which simply means stop. To me, that's intriguing. As a way of thinking literally about a God as a as an individualized being, taking a day off, that feels much less meaningful to me. Also meaningful, but less so than the wider idea of stop. Just stop. You can't be well. You can't be well in a way that says you are the people of, and this is the Hebrew mythology, right? This is the way the story is told. You can't be people that show the world what it's like to live the way the creator of the world would have creation operate unless you stop. So this is the whole story. If you want the, Old Testament in one sentence, I'm God, I'm going to give you lots of people, and lots of land, and I'm going to make you a blessing to all the nations, but you have to live the way I told you to. And if you don't, you're going to feel the other side of that. And there's the Old Testament in one sentence. That mythology, that big story, has that piece in it that says stopping is part of the way that story says people who are living as we are divinely intended to live. And whether we accept that story as the story that guides our lives, the story that governs our imagination about how things work in reality or not, it's an enduring story. It's managed to travel, among other things, from one religion into another, both of which remain significant world religions. There's a lot of people for whom this story is captivating. And there's a lot of reasons why that might be the case. One of them, I think, is because we know something about that mythology speaks truly. We can tell. We cannot believe in the existence of God, and we can tell that if we don't stop, we're not well. So that's a powerful story, right? Stories that travel with that kind of fluidity and impact across that much time and those many different ideologies and cultures and experiences. Pay attention. We need to pay attention, right? So, all to say, when we stop, and this is where the mechanistic metaphor that I was working with felt like it broke down. I just did that now. Anyway, it's so pervasive, right? Anyway, felt like it failed, as all these things do eventually. They come to their limits. But it felt like that one failed in particular because when we move into this space of stopping of receptivity even while we're moving, of being present, we realize, I think, fairly quickly that we are whole persons. We are minds, spirits, and bodies. And when we move into spaces of silence or stillness or rest, we are moving into spaces where spirit is easier to connect with. As somebody who's grown up in the Christian tradition, I've always loved that the words that that tradition's sacred texts use for breath and spirit are the same in the languages that those texts originate in. That's the same word. And so again, whether the religious understanding of this picture of what it means to be human is one that resonates for you or not, the idea that breath and being present to just that elemental reality of us as humans is also being receptive to that which is mysterious or the realm of spirit or mystery, that those things would be connected does not feel like a reach. So, to help us sort of switch metaphors, I've got some words, I've got an object, and I'm going to get some help. Words first. The words are from a poet that I've had the privilege of spending some time with and I've referenced before in this space, British author Malcolm Guite. We'll get to the object shortly, but first a poem from Malcolm. It's called The Singing Bowl. Actually, it's called Singing Bowl. There's no "the" in the title. And for Malcolm, who is deeply entrenched in the Christian tradition, there are ways in which this is an expression of what that tradition would probably use a word like prayer for. So I think that's important to know in terms of the poet's position on the words. But also, I know Malcolm well enough to know that what he would mean by prayer is a very generous idea for him. So let's just listen with that in mind. Begin the song exactly where you are. Remain within the world of which you're made. Call nothing common in the earth or air. Accept it all and let it be for good. Start with the very breath you breathe in now. This moment's pulse, this rhythm in your blood. And listen to it, ringing soft and low. Stay with the music. Words will come in time. Slow down your breathing. Keep it deep and slow. Become an open singing bowl whose chime is richness rising out of emptiness and timelessness resounding into time. And when the heart is full of quietness, begin the song exactly where you are. It's gorgeous, hey? And also instructive. That's, art can do that. And that's pretty lovely. Jane, would you come and give me a hand? I didn't spring this on Jane, by the way, just so you don't live in fear when you come to this community. We have a singing bowl, and it's been part of our community's life for a long time. And it didn't get rung this morning, but it often does to kind of call us together. Over the years, one of the things that has happened to this bowl...
Two things?
Yeah. One of the things that has happened to this bowl is that it's cracked. It's glass. And what's the other thing that's happened to it, Jane?
There used to be a ring. There was a rubber ring that sat underneath it. I think it helped with the resonance of it.
So when Jane and I discussed this, I guess there's a third thing that we talked about too, which is that the piece that comes with it for making it sing, this dowel with suede around it, has become worn enough that the suede has lost some of its friction. And so what I wanted Jane to do, because not everyone can do this, it takes some practice, is see if she would come and be willing to see if she would get it to sing for us this morning. That may or may not happen, as we discussed.
The other person in this room who can make this sing is Karen.
Yes, that's right. That's true.
And yes, send me my vibes.
we'll pool our resources such as they are. And what I said to Jane is, if in terms of what I'm trying to illustrate or help us imagine together this morning, if Jane doing the work of inviting the bowl to sing does not produce a song, that's as good a metaphor for what becoming still in silence is like in our human experience as any other metaphor I could think of. But also, we talked about the tension that's part of the actual exercise of doing this, right? And Jane, you said something that I thought was interesting about the dowel and the suede. Do you remember what we discussed? This I did spring on Jane.
Sorry.
That's quite all right. You had a million things going on when I broke into your world with this idea. As I recall, correct me if I'm wrong, but as I recall, we were talking about how the it's important that there's enough pressure, but not too much. Like if the dowel bounces when you're going around the rim of the bell, you don't get good results. And if you put too much pressure on it, it doesn't work. If you put too little pressure on it, it doesn't work. In short, it takes some practice, right? And I think, to me, that was just a rich, when Jane brought that up in our conversation, I was like, does it get any better than this metaphorically? I don't think it does. Like, in terms of practicing being still and emptying, I think it was Henri Nouwen who talked about how in his own practice of solitude and silence, as soon as he stopped to become silent, all the monkeys in his brain would start to chatter. And they usually sent one of two messages. Either he was an absolute loser and no one could ever love him, or he was very desirable. But there was like, and everyone should, but there was nothing in the middle, you know? So just all to say, to get those monkeys to be quiet. Who was that?
No.
I think it was Nouwen, Henri Nouwen. I remember it as a Nouwen thing. Yeah, some other people do as well. So anyway, all to say, right, there's some complexity to this. Jane, that's a lot of setup, but let's just see if our bell's going to sing. By the way, if anybody is sort of kind of like, what could the table really use? I'm wondering if this might be the season where we're looking for a smaller singing bowl that's made of metal.
I was just saying,
so it could translate. There's others who have bigger ones. Anyway, let's see what happens with this one this morning.
Mm-hmm.
when we give it the time to sit.
Yes.
Sometimes I'm just like, I know sometimes when I've done community time in the past, where I'm just like, screw it.
I know, right?
I don't have it in me.
Yeah. You cracked it.
I think our inability to stay in one place for any length of time is how it
sub-zero temperatures at time.
That's right.
That's exactly what did it. It was the sub-zero.
From cold to warm and back to, so. Jane, thank you.
Yeah.
So lovely.
Interesting.
Isn't it? Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's just so many layers, right, if we open ourselves to that. Well, let me just leave us with the words from the poem and that experience of that bowl singing with us. Begin the song exactly where you are. Remain within the world of which you're made. Call nothing common in the earth or air. Accept it all and let it be for good. Start with the very breath you breathe in now, this moment's pulse, this rhythm in your blood, and listen to it, ringing soft and low. Stay with the music. Words will come in time. Slow down your breathing. Keep it deep and low. Become an open singing bowl whose chime is richness rising out of emptiness and timelessness resounding into time. And when the heart is full of quietness, begin the song exactly where you are. Peace, everybody.